the street and the neighborhood is where the crises converge and we experience them the most, right? So the energy crisis or the cost of living crisis, you can see it as a concept, but where you feel it is in your everyday life. And so for us, we feel like there's a huge amount of agency and action and moments where you can demonstrate other futures possible at this scale. So we wanted to really interrogate the neighborhood as a unit of social change more deeply. And so Civic Square was born.
Welcome to The Green Urbanist, a podcast for urbanists fighting climate change. I'm Ross. Hello everyone. Today's episode is a conversation with Imi, Kavita and Charlie of Civic Square.
Hi, I'm Imi. I'm one of the co-founders at Civic Square. We're based in a inner city neighbourhood called Ladywood in Birmingham. And we are looking at neighbourhood and civic infrastructure for 21st century neighbourhoods. And prior to this, I co-founded Impact Urban and part of a collective called Zero Zero.
Hello, I'm Kavita. I'm a environmental engineer turned, well, aspiring ecological economist, I guess, is the phrase that we're going with. But I'm the regenerative economics researcher at Civic Square and really thrilled to be here.
Awesome. And Charlie?
Yeah, hi, I'm a recovering architect. I'm mainly working in the sort of, as a designer for Civic Square now, focused on the neighborhood transitions demonstrator, which I'm sure we'll get into a bit more later, but mainly it's looking at how the built environment is incorporated into just transition.
So Civic Square have been doing amazing work around systems change at the neighborhood level in Ladywood, Birmingham, where they're based. Their main projects to date include creating a neighborhood donut based on Kate Raworth's donut economics concept, and exploring the invisible infrastructure needed to transition their neighborhood towards a sustainable future. We also talk about the Civic Square, which is a public space and building that they're designing at the moment in their neighborhood in Birmingham. If we talk a fair amount about donut economics, not exclusively, but we do talk about that concept. If you've no idea what that means or you've never heard of it, I'd have done an episode on donut economics in the past, just as an introduction. The link to that is in the episode description, so if you want, go there and listen to that first or afterwards. It's definitely something worth exploring. It's really, really interesting. We also talk about in this episode, we have a long chat about how they are funded and the difficult reality of engaging in this kind of work, like meaningful systems change work that doesn't come with a blueprint, as Imi says. That's really, really interesting. So, you know, hang around after about the 20 or 30 minute mark, we get into that question, which is a really good part of the conversation. Okay, this is a longish episode. So without further ado, enjoy this conversation with Civic Square. Okay, fantastic. Well, there's loads of stuff we have to talk about, but I guess let's start, maybe get a bit more information on what is Civic Square and what... Where did it come from? Why does it exist? Maybe over to you, Imi, to start, kick that off.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, great question. It's many things all mixed up together, and it's and I think that's quite important. Where it came from really was inspired by the journey we have been on with the studio Zero Zero, which Architecture Zero Zero came out of, WikiHouse came out of, Open Systems Lab came out of, OpenDesk came out of, Dark Matter Labs did, a whole number of democratic, emerging, open source platforms looking at the future of housing, the future of planning, the future of our civic and social infrastructure. And we came across them nearly 10 years ago. And for me personally, the real inspiration was just watching many unlikely allies and people, recovering architects, people who'd come out of engineering or geography or the social sector, or in my case, the sciences and medical background, and were trying to forge new collaborative, dynamic, interdependent futures. And there were certainly people that nobody would put together, and there wasn't necessarily a blueprint for how they could do this. And I remember one of my biggest questions was, who said you could do this? When I first joined, I was quite young. I used to go around and ask some of them, like, who said you could reimagine the housing system or like rethink planning? And it really dawned on me how rigid and structured a lot of my education had been, to make me not realize that there weren't these imaginary like people that said you are allowed to rethink this structural system. And so that's like a lot of the foundations. And obviously, you know, telling you a story of 12 years in a couple of minutes is not easy. So there's loads more around that. But we were really inspired by watching these collaborative, dynamic, interdisciplinary groups of people come together and create work where there was no blueprint for that work yet. Mm. As they developed a lot of that work, in the case of, you know, WikiHouse getting millimeter precision housing technology, MMC technology, like precise, they started to realize started to discover how deep some of the entrenched systems underneath, much of that was holding so much back. So how things were financed, how they were governed, how they were owned, the land system, and so on and so on. And so came Dark Matter Labs, and that was really looking at some of this. And for us, we were organizing and convening in Birmingham. We co-founded something called Impact Hub Birmingham that really looked at what it meant to bring those complex, knotty challenges into the hands of people where they are and create those spaces for many, many different people to come together, build the open movements, build the literacy, the resources to act on that. From there, though, we really realized that there's a limit to how much we can do until we start to really unpick some of these, like I term the dark matter, other people talk them invisible structures, you know, how the land is owned, how things are financed. And from this incredible movement we had at the Impact Hub, which was citywide, that we'd crowdfunded and built together, we knew that it was time to take the next leap, to really look at what it meant to make change and transformative change alongside people in places like Birmingham, in the inner city, the places that are least expected for like the most transformative ideas and projects to first be born. You know, they're thought of in think tanks or in architecture studios or in policy places in central London, but actually you wanted to really make and demonstrate it. And for us, I can summarize really why Civic Square exists into one line, which is that the street and the neighborhood is where the crises converge and we experience them the most, right? So the energy crisis or the cost of living crisis, you can see it as a concept, but where you feel it is in your everyday life. And so for us, we feel like there's a huge amount of agency and action and moments where you can demonstrate other futures possible at this scale. So we wanted to really interrogate the neighborhood as a unit of social change more deeply. And so Civic Square was born. And I can tell you a bit more about this as we chat, because I think that this is not some new idea. We have historic precedents of infrastructuring transitions and how crucial democratic access to tools, knowledge, spaces, resources at a neighborhood and at a street level was critical to those transitions. And we can talk about those later on. But that's who we are. We're based in Ladywood in Birmingham. And we can talk more about all the bits and bobs and how we're thinking about that through this next bit.
So there was three things. I had a chat with Charlie before this that we could talk about. One is the Civic Square as a physical place. The neighborhood donut, and then your work around neighborhood transitions. So I don't know who wants to kick us off with what, or give us a little overview of why those three things are, why you're working on those.
Yeah, I'll give a little overview and then I'll pass over to these guys to talk more. And I'll loop it back to the first thing that we talked about, that we come from this we don't necessarily come from it ourselves, right? But we're part of this ecosystem of people and partners. And I think the economist Carlota Perez talks about this beautifully, where she talks about transitions require institutional infrastructural responses, right? She talks about it, and institution doesn't have to be big and heavy, but the scale of transition we need to go through requires an infrastructure response. There's a couple of really clear examples we can talk about in the history of England and the UK, given that that's where we are. You know, the imperial example of post-war, the country needing to rebuild itself, and the identification that health was a key part of that, and the forming of the NHS. The NHS was a national system, a regional system, but it understood really clearly that you can't just shout at people from a prime ministerial pedestal, can you go and get healthy? We need to increase the productivity. And I'm doing air quotes for a moment on productivity, just so for all the reasons we'll know about later. But they built the neighborhood GPs, right? Which was the democratic access to health, the tools, resources, and any appropriate expertise that was required at the scale of the neighborhood. The same is true of the community libraries compared to the learning shift that happened in the transition between more manual and industrial work towards more technological and information-based. In the end, when you need a whole society to transition to get smarter or to get healthier or to have more appropriate responses to the current conditions, you would need to be able to support that in significant ways. And you would have to, in the end, whatever side of the political spectrum you're on this, people have to have access to the tools and resources to be part of that. And so for us, Civic Square is about this story. It is, what is a 21st and 22nd century infrastructure required to give people in their places democratic access to the tools, the resources, the expertise, the convening, and so on and so on. Because like the community libraries before it, like the GPs, you have to have that within close distance of where you are to be able to meaningfully engage. And so one part of our work is a real transformation of an old industrial site to demonstrate what some of that can look like, to show the micro factories, the community kitchens, the spaces, the work spaces, the type of public squares at the heart of our neighbourhoods that would be important. But we're not just interested in massive capital transformations, because we really believe that every empty space and part of the built environment and empty high streets and shopping precincts and front lawns and school playgrounds and roofs are all going to be an active working part of this transition, and it is going to need all of that. So the way we've then set up the work is to really look at what is the physical infrastructure, what is the new direction, or what is the direction of this future economy, right, which Gavita can talk about with our work around a real compass for and baseline for us to look at where we are and where we need to head, no matter how complex that is. And then what is the really tangible street-based organising to demonstrate that transition, and in many cases that also that built environment transition in practice, which Charlie can talk about more. So we sit. The overall overview framing of this is we are now in a stage where we've done loads of incredible work over the last few years, but we now want to physically and tangibly demonstrate that we are in an era that requires new infrastructures, and those infrastructures might be retrofitting and repurposing existing things, but everybody has to get on the train of climate, social, and ecological transition. And the way that everybody can get onto it is that not just the infrastructure that we're talking about, obviously this has to be met by societal legislation, vision, et cetera, but not to ignore the street and the neighbourhood as this nice place where you just consult residents later on, or where you do beautiful palliative activities while everything's burning around them. But it's lovely because we were all together and for a moment we forgot what was really happening. But instead, you make that whole element of the work a really key, in fact, for me, a missing part. I don't think that we can transition at the scale we need to and at the pace we need to unless we really truly understand that everybody has to be part of that. And we might be on the moral, just and equitable side of that story in our politics, but I think we're at a stage where this transcends which side of the story you're on. Pragmatically, I don't think we can get there unless we're really devolving and distributing and creating democratic access to the tools and the knowledge and the spaces. So that's Civic Square as a whole. And if you go to like anywhere on social media, you'll see a little bit of the scale of the Capital Project and the site that we're transforming. But the others can really talk about some of the deep work that's starting to underpin that. And the word demonstrate for us is really critical now. We want to make sure in the next couple of years, all of these bold ideas that we have imagined in a lot of the things you can see about us online, and a lot of our friends and partners have, you can now touch, see and feel them in practice.
Awesome. Yeah. Over, let's keep going. Over to you, Charlie or Kavita, whoever wants to go next.
Maybe it'd be useful to do the donut first, Kavita.
Yeah, no problem.
Great.
So the Donut Economics Lab essentially has been a big part of what Civic Square was organizing in the last 3 years that Emmy had mentioned, and has been a really big part of like how we use the Donut Economics framing to create something that's a tangible tool. And the I know that you guys have talked about the Donut Economics theory in another episode. Plug it in here. So I won't go too much into the depths of what that's been, but what Civic Square has tried to do throughout having used this framework has been to play with the ideas that are in the book, take them off the page and make them really personable and really relational. So And the Deal platform, Donut Economics Action Lab platform, have a way to, they have like suggested methodologies on how to create what they call portraits of place. And the idea is that when you create this portrait of place, that you end up with this image of essentially where your place lies within the framework of the donut. So over 3 years, Civic Square has been working on creating a portrait of place for the community portrait, as well as the data portrait. And this has all led up to, I've actually got it here, right here. This is our like pamphlet. And it basically has given us a way of quantifying, you know, how the neighborhood's performing in the housing sector, or how the neighborhood is performing against things like climate change or ocean acidification. And once we have this image, which it's like a relatively incomplete image because we have a big design challenge of trying to get all of the components of the donut into this image that's really like coherent. But once you have this image, it functions as that compass that Emmy mentioned. And so that's largely where that work has come up to. And we've socialized the idea through various ways with intergenerational practice in the community, through beyond school activities, with co-creation weeks. We've socialized it through the context of when the IPCC IPCC AR6 reports were released in late 2021 and 2022. We socialized them through street parties and our co-creation weeks. We created zines. All of that was done through the idea of like socializing what these concepts really mean and getting people's literacy up to a place where these concepts are no longer alien and are something that people can really act on. And then we did the data portrait, which is largely where I worked last year. And we've created this report. And now the next stages of this is kind of using that compass that we've created to get into like what Emmy said earlier about like the rolling up your sleeves next stages of trying to figure out what that next bit of coherence is. And so what we envisage happening over the next couple of years is to really take each elements of the dimensions they're called, so something like housing or energy or air pollution, these are all dimensions within the donut. We're trying to think about how we take those into deeper stages of exploration and understanding how to engage community members and neighbors and other practitioners in the area to really get them to places that people understand their deep interconnections with the other areas, the other dimensions, in a way that's that's about people's lived realities, and be that being a way that we can create much more depth to these areas. And there's a couple of things that we're hoping to do within that. I'm happy to talk a little bit more about that if that makes sense. But yeah, we're really trying to think about what the next stages of that coherence building and making it about people really is. And it's deeply also connected to the transitions work. So the transitions work and the neighborhood donut work are really like deeply interlinked. So I don't know if now's a good time to explain a little bit about transitions, Charlie.
Yeah, so I think holding that idea of the neighborhood donut work as kind of like a compass is really useful because it essentially, it gives people organizing at the scale we're organizing at a much better understanding of how to position themselves and direct the work that they're doing, particularly when tools like, the donut economics framework, while they are, incredibly useful, they are typically held at the sort of like state global level. So from the point of view of people trying to organize, maybe like the grassroots scale, for example, it's hard to make the most of these tools. So I think neighborhood transitions is an example of how we can take the neighborhood donuts a compass and really use it to inform what we're organizing around in our sort of homes and streets and neighborhoods. So I think going back to, the kind of language of the demonstrators, I think neighborhood transitions is about looking at a section of the built environment near where we're based in Ladywood, Birmingham, as a demonstrator for how the built environment can transition as part of the wider just transition that we know has to happen. And again, I think revisiting that kind of historical precedent of the NHS is really instructive here, because the organization that became the NHS was originally the Tredegar Medical Aid Society. And this was a sort of small-scale, philanthropically funded and, working-class organized medical facility in South Wales that presented a model. It was the demonstrator for what eventually became a national program of the NHS. So in this very neighborhood, small-scale context of South Wales, this medical aid society were able to demonstrate what socialized healthcare could look like and the sort of contributions it could make. Mm-hmm. And thinking about the context we're in today and the context specifically of social and ecological crises, nothing, as far as I'm concerned, really captures the entangled nature of all of this, as well as cities and the built environment, because housing not only affects, if we have shelter or not, but we know that bad quality housing costs the NHS £1.4 billion a year. We know that housing exacerbates inequality through access to work and amenities, things like this. So everything we talk about through tools like donut economics is manifested in the built environment tangibly as these dimensions, like Kavita was saying. So, this is why for us thinking of a neighborhood transition is a really important way of how we can kind of intervene and demonstrate what we think has to happen at that national scale. So to get, just very tangible with all of this, what we're trying to do is we're looking at a street in Ladywood and we're thinking about how can this street be deeply retrofit in a way that is sort of owned and governed by the people who live there. So when we say deep retrofit, we're not just talking about slapping some insulation on the outside of the house. We're talking about things like thinking about the infrastructure needed for housing. So things like water capture, things like food production, composting, we're talking also about obviously all these important things around energy efficiency, reducing the sort of carbon impact of housing, and then, yeah, essentially trying to use this demonstrator of Link Road and the sort of neighborhood transition that's happening in Ladywood and in Birmingham as a way for as a way to advocate for this at a national scale. So it's sort of framed within this idea that the most effective way we can address the condition of the existing built environment in the UK is through this neighborhood approach, because at that scale you can get the sort of the just aspect of the just transition, you can get the effective uptake and interest and legibility of the work. So taking that and then pairing it with the ambition and resource of the public program, which is why we're seeing all of this as something that we're thinking about as a public civic partnership, as opposed to the contentious public private partnerships that we're far more used to. So, so this, again, just I think with transitions in particular, holding the idea of the demonstrator as a strategy for how we're trying to actually take this from the philanthropic small scale to the national scale is a really kind of important aspect of it.
I love that, and I really like that explanation of the NHS and where that came from and how you're sort of learning from that. I think that was fascinating. Is the idea that these projects, you'll sort of get these sort of tangible learnings from the projects that you can then disseminate and people can just take it and run with it and do it in their own way?
Yeah, so I guess a lot of our, the way we work and design and try and show up in the world is in that way, and to regularly and as quickly as possible, whether it's in the everyday storytelling and sharing and amplification of things that our peers and that we're doing, or it's more periodically, larger events, publications, sharing things before they're quite ready, talking about it often. Yes, absolutely, that's the case. And I think what's really important from what Charlie has said is that this framing of kind of the public civic, the trying to draw inspiration from things like the NHS and other things, it's really like it's a very kind of sensible rooted version of ourselves, because what's really interesting is that, like, the last 10 years we've really been in trying to open the Overton window of like possibility of like discourse around, more decolonial, equitable, just, bold, radical movements, work led by leaders and communities of colour, of the peers like our friends at Maya, who are bringing forth the work of the Black imagination and Black land and spatial justice and all of this, right? And now we're kind of in this space where it's not just an age thing. It's kind of like, because, there's lots of people in the team for whom this is like one of their first jobs. But it's also just where we are at this critical juncture in, the last 10 years of political turmoil that we have sat within. The fact that some of us have watched everything that we knew as a country holds forth the social foundation, and we still weren't, meeting everybody's needs in a just and equitable way, being ripped away. And so we're at this precipice now of like, well, what parallels can we draw to other like non just like, left or right stories of change, but and also where they came from. So I think that piece that Charlie talked about around working class rooted deep like micro demonstrators as an example is crucial to us. And yeah, the point is that we don't build hundreds of civic squares. The point is we share the ideas and stories quickly and as widely as possible, but rooted within a story that the next prime minister or administration could also pick up like confidently as well about the public and public civic partnership. The only thing I would say to anybody listening is that, just to add that nuance, is we're not so naive that we think that, like the people setting up the Tredegar Medical Aid Society didn't think they were going to go and be the eve of the NHS when they were doing it right. It was built from a working class, deeply rooted, radical solidarity and understanding of the needs of a completely under-resourced portion of society, where healthcare was seen as for those who could afford it or those who deserved it, and everybody else kind of just dealt with their hand, right? So it's not like we're sitting here saying, hey, like, we think that Civic Square's demonstrators, somebody will tell a story about them in this way in the future, precisely to do with us. What I do think is really important is that all of us in this field need to get out in and be in the homes and the places and the neighborhoods that we actually think this stuff needs to happen to. Like, there's such a lot in the built environment where people will describe what needs to happen, and it's like, no, but somebody else needs to do that bit, right? It's like, we need these one-stop retrofit shops. We need better this. We need, and it's like, who are these imaginary people that we're talking to, right? For me, it was always about being able to now distribute ourselves and get into a place that was legitimate and home for us and actually build some of that. So it's kind of also encouraging others to lean even more to the arc of demonstration, to influence policy, to think about their own integrity and legitimacy in this, and get out of that office and go and see what it means to try and build that thing somewhere, and not just sketch on a piece of paper that some this imagined community person is going to build this movement, or some this imagined person is going to go and consult or build the retrofit shop or care or to transform the front gardens. It's kind of like this story between radical grassroots organizing and structuring that into a societal shift, but not pretending that we can just do that sat in our offices describing on paper to others this imagined change that's going to happen once we all get the money organized and the ideas right. And so yes, it's like a mixture of those things. It's an open source methodology, but it's also a real encouragement to people to roll their sleeves up and maybe radically reconsider how their practices are set up. Like, is it right that we're just sat in the same model, producing reports and talking about policy recommendations for other people to build? And the greatest example, I would say, in the UK of this right now is the work done by We Can Make in Bristol. Melissa Mean has done some stunning, stunning work on what could really make a big dent in the housing shortages that we are currently facing, the housing crisis that we're currently in, by demonstrating in a council-built estate in Norwest, an incredible way that people who are unhoused or in overcrowding or in poor quality housing can create a new supply of land and use MMC to build it. And she's just completed the first two homes with three wonderful neighbours in Norwest. But alongside that has a set of policy recommendations that could make this infill and small site housing revolution get unlocked, has demonstrated it with people, has shown those that nobody in the mainstream discourse would be pointing to as leading the housing innovation revolution. And so it's about that mixture. Open sourcing, yes, but I've never seen the endless toolkits to people make them be able to do that next bit, which is figuring out where they are legitimate to build or to get more hands-on. And I just think that there is a real call to this whole field and sector to like know the role of influencing policy, government, creating big picture visions and huge buildings and huge moments, but also know the role of like not just othering this responsibility onto some other person that you think is going to make this idea that you've written in your report actually happen, because it's really humbling to get down to the scale of the neighborhood and see what it means to just manifest any of that. And of course that is massively held back by the societal, socioeconomic, societal and legislative backdrop. But to say that I think we can influence that far better by being able to show people things that they can touch, see, feel, experience, not just merely policy recommendations in a report, although they are really important. This is not a bashing of policy wonks. We just need to, it needs to go a bit further. And that's the kind of breadth, I would say, between open source demonstration and not othering this responsibility to this imagined other person you think is going to bring your report to life, and really engaging with how that might happen.
Well, I'll ask the obvious question first, which is how are you funded? You know, we'd all love to get into systems change, but how do you actually do it without someone, you know, earning a commercial fee for it, in a sense?
Great question. And I think this is a really important one. And the last podcast I did on this, I was quite brutally honest about this. And I thought that podcast would fall apart and people would really be disappointed on Twitter, but actually it seemed to have got great feedback. And so I think this is a really critical question, because there's a whole story about how I think it should be funded, how I think we grow this work, but in reality how a lot of this work happens. And so people like ourselves, prior to Civit Square, and I'll share how we're funded like now in a moment, there's not some magic story. Like, there's not this magic like tree of money elsewhere that those that leave architecture or leave the big corporate industries go to. They shake it and there is all the like funds for them to go on this other journey. And I have to say, one of the things I'm really, really grateful for is I learned this quite early on. I remember one of the first conversations I had with Indy Johar, who after I'd got over the like, who said you could do this, right? Like, I don't get it. Like, who said you could do this? Was really clearly, how have you made this happen? And we know there are entanglements of all sorts of things, right? So in a lot of the building of this work, I think there are, the reality is people are doing a couple of different jobs, first of all. Sometimes they're teaching and they're doing a job like this, or they're doing something else at the weekend and they're trying to like find how to make this work happen. And over the first 10 years between watching a lot of, and it's tied up in privilege and can you live with your parents and can you do all of this? Like, there was a lot of that in the first 10 years of this work. We crowdfunded Impact Hub. We ran it on revenue that we could generate and then reinvest that back into any little extra bit that we could find, reinvest that back into things we wanted to test to try and build a runway of legitimacy and like projects that actually could be funded in a bolder way. So there's like this journey, and I know that others from OpenDES, from Architecture 00, there's a mixture of getting commissions, getting pieces of work you want to do to be able to do something else, a lot of personal investment, collective investment. And so there is a lot of, there's a really bumpy journey, I think, in how things like this are born. And then we had sort of 4 or 5 years being quite lowly paid, but earning revenue from the building that we ran, and reinvesting that back in. And what that did as a group of largely people of colour, trying to organise and lead, was build a legitimacy that allowed us to start talking about larger interventions, larger things that we wanted to see and do. So, and this might not be the sexiest way you want to hear about this. So somebody gets to them, they're like, what the punchline of this is that you've worked for hardly anything for 10 years. For funders to then say, oh, we believe you, right? And so I'm just being quite honest, because I do want to like demystify some of this. I want to demystify how people think a thing like Dark Matter Labs or Civit Square comes to life. There's normally like this small group of people who've done absurd things for a long time until they catch enough of a wind that peeps are like, hey, okay, we can invest. So we are very gratefully on a little arc of that journey now, where at the end of Hub, we went to a number of philanthropic funders and said, we need some research and development funding and time. And so we had a 3-year runway. For us, Paul Hamlin, the National Lottery Community Fund, and Esme Fairburn stepped forward in that first journey. It was for 3 years so that we could build the physical element of the infrastructure, where we would then generate a revenue and create a more balanced model of having a revenue generation stream that was hopefully more 21st century and regenerative and cyclical, but would be able to keep us out of having to do high levels of being funded in a more charitable way. And that's where we are now, but the pandemic affected that quite a bit. So we're just about to go into another small extension of that to give us a bit more space as the development of our physical site comes back to life. So there is a period of time now where we are resourced and funded. And I can, you know, there's other ways that other partners of ours are, a mixture of commissions and funding, a mixture of consultancy and funding. But I would say that this is an emerging space. Creating work that there is no blueprint for is very, very hard to get funded. And as particularly organizers or leaders of color, the journey to legitimacy is significant, right? Like you have to, like I've had to really prove, overly prove myself to be able to just even exist within this space. But more exciting than that is that we have like lots of journeys and work that we are doing about how we think this could be funded, and how this work in this interim space needs to be resourced. And there are the emerging like green shoots of some of that starting to come to life now. But I always think being a bit honest about this is important, because someone out there is going to be like, how can you do this? And it's like, you know, there isn't just this other world that exists that you just go knock on the door of and then you're in. Unfortunately, it is like a real, and it's really inaccessible if you don't have something or someone or a job or a parent or something that you can live in. Is this, you can't just magic this out of nowhere. And certainly like our journey of that has been bumpy, but also we're really lucky to have the resource now that we do, but it doesn't come without some real, like, I'm really disappointed at how much as a field we are having to fight for something more than 1-3 year project funding at a time where we've got to step up as a generation like never before. So yeah, that's a little bit of us and how we're currently funded and hopefully where we're moving towards.
That's really interesting. And I think an interesting question to think about is for people who are maybe at the beginning of the journey, would, like, if you were back at the beginning again, would you do it all over again? Or knowing what you know now, would you do things differently? And what advice would you give?
I've got a Twitter thread that I was just drafting about this. So yeah, I actually really do. And would I do it all again? Yeah, I would. As much as that pains me to say it. And I can see my colleagues laughing their head off because I've just gone through like quite a difficult year. And I have to say, even if I did it all again, I absolutely would. I have to say that as I believe as a generation, we are like relatively privileged. Even though we are sitting within systems of oppression as people of color in this country, like we are relatively privileged and resourced compared to like most of the world, right? And I think not only has it been the work of my life, the privilege of my life, I think it's also responsibility. It really is. And I would like a softer and slower life, and I'd love to be the dream of my ancestors, but I'm pretty sure my ancestors would also talk about this being like how you show up in the world is context specific, and we're in a crisis, and we've got to do everything we can with that. And I use the word crisis with some like connotations as well, but like, yeah, I would. And my advice would be twofold. This is going to take everything you've got. It really is. Building work that has no blueprint is going to take the most radical amount of relationality with your peers. It's going to take you to transform yourself and work in a way that makes you deeply uncomfortable. The wins you're going to have and the moments of joy and hope that you can create not only for yourself, for your peers, but for those around you are unfathomable. Like there's no other work I've ever done that brings as much joy and as much satisfaction as breaking through like a moment where you know things will never be the same again as a result of that, and you're moving that you've made the next part of the blueprint. So I do think this is this, the only way to find like joy and satisfaction in the world we are currently in this country to through work is to find a way to liberate yourself in the scale of challenge that is coming, and to surround yourself with peers that are on that journey. And that might be hard. It might be harder than comfortable truths that linear management and work tries to tell you to keep status quo going. But once you're in that, it's incredible. It's been the hardest work I've ever done, but I would never go back. But I would say my advice would be, is that when you first go into like organization, like there's a lot of organizations now this last 10 years, you know, there's so many places you could go to work. Loads of our peers, wonderful people like Healing Justice, We Can Make, Zero Zero, Dark Matter Labs, Centric Labs. We, you know, compared to 10 years ago, there are so many people I could point to go, they're doing radical work and wow, they've built something where they're hiring and so on. But when you get to that, I really, really would make sure you spend time with the people who've done that work and understand what it's taken for them to get there. Maybe not necessarily treat them the same way you would a corporate, huge profit extracting architecture firm, and really ask them about what their journey has been and what it means to join that journey. Obviously make sure they don't take the mick out of you, or they're not extracting you for like huge amounts of profit, or they're treating you really badly or paying you badly. But I can say in the field that I've seen, this is not necessarily what's happening. But if you're coming to build, think really clearly about the work you might have to do on yourself to be in as part of that, the radical relationships you might have to just go, tell me about what the last 10 years has been like. Because 10 years ago, there weren't these jobs. They didn't have pensions. They didn't have a team. They didn't have a blueprint. And a lot of people have created that. And that's amazing. And it doesn't mean that there is a gatekeeping and it should just stay the same. But building something is quite different to being employed by a linear pathway. And I would just say that my advice would be, it is the greatest, most satisfying work, but it is so hard and it takes so much of us that the radical relationships and connectivity are really, really crucial. So when you go in wide-eyed, enthusiastic, and really excited to be part of this journey, try and interrogate some of that and really think about what it means for you to show up in that, because there is no, again, like I said, there's no magic place. It is just lots of people rolling up their sleeves and trying to give form to these bold ideas, trying to give them the next bit of coherence and the next bit of craft and form so that they can show up in the world and become something. And I sometimes feel that there's this idea that there's this magic place where all of that happens. And I certainly know I had it when I first joined. I thought there's this place, like, but then you just realize, oh no, it's just you and your peers and what you're making and what you're putting out in the world and what movements you're building. So yeah, go into it thoughtfully as well as wholeheartedly is my bits of advice.
Wow, lots of food for thought there. Thank you so much. I want to give a chance for Charlie and Kavita to come in on that if you want before we move on to talking about your projects.
Yeah, I think maybe one thing that's interesting about, I guess, something that a lot of people in Civic Square have in common, not everyone, but a lot of people in the team, I think, have a sort of almost origin story or a background that's rooted in, you know, like activism, organizing, community work, things like this. And I think what one thing that's really important just in terms of keeping yourself grounded in doing this kind of work is to kind of routinely acknowledge that the vast, vast majority of systems change work or moving or just transition work or moving to an emergent economic system, however you want to call it, the vast majority of that is unpaid organizing, because essentially you're sort of agitating against the status quo to some extent or another. So I think one thing that is really great for that kind of radical organizing and relationship building that Imi was talking about in Civic Square is that a lot of us come from a place where doing that kind of work is you are just doing it usually at a cost to, you know, yourself, your free time. It's almost never paid. So I think then being able to step into a sort of organizing environment where, you know, there is this kind of like, that there's been this long process of building and kind of getting through that to a point where there is resource and there is support and there is, you know, like Amy said, pensions to actually do this work in a resourced way. It is, it is a privilege. And I think it is, absolutely something that we're all kind of constantly reminding ourselves of and constantly thinking about how we can best leverage that, privilege. But, it's interesting. Like, obviously you don't want to get into the place where you're sort of putting this in such a sort of special environment that it becomes destructive to yourself. But at the same time, yeah, I think it is really important to acknowledge that most people doing this kind of system change work just do it through activism, or they do it through community organizing or mutual aid, things like that. And it's incredible to be in an environment where we are resourced to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't have a lot to add to that other than, you know, the integrity that we're trying to bring with the privilege that we do have. And, you know, Amy spoke about being relatively privileged in the wider global context as well to be able to do this work. I mean, it's really significant, the position that we're in. And so the integrity that we're trying to bring at every stage, it requires to like constantly be learning about who else is in the ecosystem of this work, who else is doing the work, who else is pushing the field, what other new skills and contexts that we need to be considering. So the relationality within that is like unbelievably fundamental to us being able to sustain ourselves in this, which is also like another like benefit, because like you end up working with people that you actually like give two hoots about, and that in itself is another like privilege. Lol, don't let it get to your head, guys.
I was gonna say, oh, thanks, that's so nice.
I was like, just two hoots.
Oh damn, okay,
where's my third hoot?
But I think that, Ross, it's really important with what Charlie and Kavita and I have said, not to lose the nuance of why I also feel like it's important for people who are in positions like mine, and this is definitely one thing that I've learned over last year, is what it means to create those conditions as well. Because what can happen is you get to like some sort of savior complex of like, don't you know what I've done to create this, right? And that isn't the story I'm trying to tell here, because that isn't necessarily everyone's problem, right? It's about and especially that doesn't translate well when, you know, if architects are listening to this, or, you know, big companies are listening to this, if you extract, and Charlie, you know, does this language really well, but if you extract labor from your employees to take a shareholder profit, and then you're telling them to come in and be like, do you know what it took me to build this? And now you guys should be like, that is not what I am talking about here. Okay. Do not take this lesson from this. What I am talking about is the arc of organizing and work where you're trying to build democratic structures, fairly equal pay or pay according to responsibility, much more democratic, open organizing. You're trying to create a way for this not to become the thing that you do in the evenings or weekends while you do your main job to pay your bills. When you're in that, and there is an absolute deep like commitment to building a democratic space to work and organize, even though that might not be perfect in a world that is like employment law doesn't necessarily lean towards the arc of justice, is basically that it's within that we need to think about how we're showing up, right? And that's why I don't want people to take the wrong thing from here, because a lot of toxic, particularly masculinity, can be like, hey, I built this thing, you don't know how hard I worked, and you guys need to come and be, that's not it. Particularly within this, though, it's important to go back to the first point I was saying, is we've had to keep really interrogating our role in that as we've grown the team, because even in saying that, none of the team or the younger team members or people who've joined are immune to the fact that we're in a cost of living crisis, the fact that our salaries might be better than they were when we were on naught or £100 a week or something, but they are nowhere near what the mainstream pay would be on these sorts of things. And this is where I do think, like, my conversation back to the early funder point is really clear, which is that we have to resource this work better longer term, because I have just seen years and years and years of brilliant people take other routes that weren't, let me just build the biggest career I can by myself out of this, to do this more collective and collaborative work that is pushing boundaries. And it comes at a cost. It comes at a cost always. So what I said before in my advice is also, like, it's not a one-way thing. If you are in stewarding a team or you're in that space, there's also a lot to be done to figure out these balances that you're holding whilst you're trying to build from a privileged position and with resources, but also to look at the wider socioeconomic context. We are in a really, really difficult place, and these last 3 years, for certain over the last 12, have been the most difficult in managing so many of those health, well-being, economic, pay, just like everything is really, really hard. So I'd say my advice goes both ways, not just to those looking for what to do, but also really interrogate who you are within this, okay? Because I do not want to hear, like, some founder of a massive practice who's earning £200,000 a year and taking home £1 million a year for his shareholders saying, I heard Imi Kaur say on a podcast somewhere that, you know, those little youngsters that are coming in, they should be damn grateful what it took to build this thing. No, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about organizers, movement builders, people who are trying to build democratic organizations, how difficult it is in this context, what it means to resource it, and then what it means to be someone who shows up into it and says, I want to build, but also has to recognize, like, yo, this is not going to be that easy either. And it's not just like a job. It's just not like every job that you're going to find where you can just go to HR with every problem, and every time you need a pay rise, there will be one. And every time, because it is just people who were trying to say, is there a better way for us to do this? Like, is there a way that we can do this not in the evenings and weekends? And I think that's like, and it become our work and our life. And is there a way that we don't over professionalize it to the point where it loses its radical and revolutionary roots? Because naturally that does happen as well. And these are just contradictions we sit within, and to interrogate them with the people you want to go and work with, and not see yourselves outside of that, as in, well, they're the bosses and we're the employees, they can figure all that out. Because that's not actually true in this typology of work. And I can
say
that
you're not a CEO.
I'm not a CEO. And
no girl boss.
No girl boss over here. And you can see that, like, if you go and talk to any of our peers over the years, founders, people doing this, they're all grappling with these same types of ideas, a sense of real responsibility to the next generation of this work, and just like, just a person who was like, maybe we should earn a bit more and have safer conditions to do this work, and maybe it'll be good that it's like more legitimate and recognized by the field as work as well. So yeah, those just some clarity points, because I know this little conversation can really get lost in nuance once you're listening to it as well, and I think it's really important to be able to think about that.
Yeah, thank you for that was brilliant. Does anyone want, in the last sort of few minutes, do you want to briefly touch on the Civic Square, that sort of physical space, and then we can do a little wrap up?
Yeah, we can do. I mean, Kavita, Charlie and I have been working in this in different ways. And like I said, we've got a large kind of abandoned public kind of old industrial site that happens to be conveniently shaped as a beautiful square at the heart of the neighborhood that was due for demolition and then was due to have housing built on it. And then we made a bit of a case to the public, to the private developer, to turn this into something better. They were like, okay, you can have a 5-year lease. We were like, no way. We know exactly what that story is. okay, you can have a 10-year lease. No, thanks. Okay, what about 100 years? Okay, that's maybe a start. And now we're in a journey of buying the freehold because we want to fundamentally rewrite some of the rules underneath that. And if we had, like you said, if we had all afternoon, we could talk about this idea of property rights, finance, governance, all the dark matter invisible in structures that impact that. So there's a piece where we're trying to craft a new covenant that is donor inspired socially and ecologically that would sit underneath that site. And then practically, what are the modules, like we said, of the types of tools and resources people need? Norwest have shown how powerful a micro factory is in a neighborhood to be able to learn skills, build new homes, make, repair, mend, etc., etc. So there's that piece. And then there's the third layer, which is how can this demonstrate social and ecological like standards? And I don't know if you, Gavita, want to share a little bit about what we started to imagine with some of the graduates at Centre for Alternative Technology who have pioneered this for a while around all the other ways this building might demonstrate high performance and adaptation and other things. If we'll share a little bit about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So like Emmy said, this is it's like an old industrial building, and typically these have had like significant amounts of construction happen to them, and they may have been passed through various hands in the past. But one thing about the built environment is it contains a lot of what's like stored carbon. So we know that like taking buildings down just for the sake of building something on top of it is incredibly damaging to the environment in multiple different ways, as well as it being resource intensive. And so when we envisage what this building could be, there's just like an endless possibility of like how this building can be like a visual, physical demonstration of all of the possibilities of what regenerating a building that has really good bones could be, you know. So we're thinking, so we had a day with some of the alumni and some current students of Centre for Alternative Technology, who are an amazing postgraduate university and research centre in North Wales. And some of the students came down and we had kind of like a spec day where we were just trying to figure out like what are the actual like tangible examples of things that just going transitioning from what's possible to maybe what's practicable. And so we had this wonderful day where we just like immersed ourselves in possibility and transitioning to that into like, okay, well, realistically, we can put solar panels on the roofs, or we can transition, like we can get them some ground source heat pumps as well as water source heat pumps because we're based on the canal. We can transition the whole wall so that it becomes like a green space that demonstrates how we can do like vertical farming. And these are just some of the examples of the possibilities of what could be here. And we, you know, pairing that with the micro factories and the possibility of having a trade school and this being a place that's like convivially active in the neighborhood, this then becomes a place that is like a site of learning. It's a site of convening. It's a site that people come to throughout, you know, it's hopefully like more than 100 years that we get this for, that just lives and breathes itself as a place that people can learn from and add to and be part of what regeneration and redistribution of resources really looks like in like a physical context of place. So that's kind of the idea based on what that was. And it was such an amazing day. We even had John Christopher's come down for the day, who's an amazing architect who has created his own zero carbon house. And he was just like, I mean, well, he amongst the rest of the students were just like, this is like an amazing space. We can do so much with this. We can put this up here and we can put that up here. And how would you like to use this space? And what's the purpose of like how people will come into the space? So we know that like the realities of what could be are so like vast and expansive. And and I'm personally like really grateful for like all of the work that's trying to uncover like what that land contracting really looks like that Emmy is holding down like so like momentously, because what this could be for the neighborhood and like as a demonstrator and setting a precedent of is I think nothing short of historic.
Wow, I can't wait to visit. When is it going to be ready?
Well, I mean, that is a really good question, right? And I guess, like, as we come into sort of towards the end of the podcast, and Charlie always has really good final words, so I'm going to set him up to have the final word of this podcast.
No pressure.
So feel free to say whatever you like at the end, Charlie. But yeah, like, I think that piece that Kavitha just talked about and what we're talking about here is, you know, at the fundamental heart of this, we have, number one, had a horrendous extraction and destruction of much that we knew and learned over hundreds of years were important to the social foundation of a country, right? There's no doubt about it for me. Politically, I have been able to work over both decades. It's been a total joke this last decade, and it's made everything more difficult. What that has led to has it's led to us having an eradication of our imagination. It has led to us not being able to find one another, to know that there is all this remarkable, inspired, like really like incredibly rooted in evidence and practice. For example, the Center for Alternative Technology, who have been there for nearly 40 years, and we're talking about Roots for Zero Carbon Britain far, far before a lot of the current discourse. And what it means is we've lost each other. We have been time scarce, time poor. The battle for the basics, the literal basics, have become so significant that they're sucking up all of the organizing time, and rightly so. You know, it's disgrace that food banks and other things are needed in the way they are, but of course communities should be putting their energy into mutual aid and supporting one another. But what it's meant is that we've reduced down the possibility to there's some important people who will level up the country, and then the rest of us will just carry on in this way. And then you have moments like what has been convening here over the last 3 to 5 years, what's been happening in Northwest, where you start to realize, no, hold on a second. There are people from across many different disciplines, many different environments, who believe something much bolder, much better, much more dynamic, just, equitable, regenerative, inspiring is possible. And when that happens, and the reason why we want to demonstrate that is we want to show that there is so much work happening already that is, if it's just orientated, and if we can find our collective confidence and imagination and resistance again, that there is a possibility. And I know it's really difficult with what all the science is showing us, but we should never give up to it being too late to dramatically and radically shift. And I think in the West, if you can't imagine yourself, like, compared to the floods in Bangladesh or what's happening in Pakistan right now, because it doesn't feel real to you, then look at what's happening in places like America in the extreme weather. Our built environment there is becoming places that people line up their sleeping bags as disaster management centers, as people's homes are destroyed, and so on and so on. And so for me, there still really is a chance to do something remarkable. There is the talent and the skills and the imagination at all scales of society that has been purposely pulled away from one another, has been under-resourced and separated, that, you know, what we want to do is show here in inner city Birmingham, look what could be possible if we just thought about it differently. And so what Kavitha was saying there, and what you probably heard from Charlie, is for us, the donor isn't this project. It's not this project over here. It's like a fundamental compass that says, if that's that horrible picture that you saw of everything overshooting in the red of our donor, and you can see it online, what would it mean for the building to, like Kavitha said, generate energy, capture water, be socially radically appropriate to the neighbourhood that's around it, be adaptive to what's coming, to extreme temperatures, to potential drought, to many other functions our built environment is going to have to support us to convene around in the future. And I just want to say that really clearly, that it's one thing doing a capital project because you want to put your name to something and say you built that, And I just think that's literally the opposite reason why we want to do this. I really, really feel like the last decade has been devastating for the collective imagination and the collective solidarity of these movements. And we are all out here, and we are so lucky at Civic Square. We get to meet them so often, and we need to find one another, and we need to manifest this. Not so radical. Like, it's not that radical. Like, we know what we need to do. We need to manifest it. We touch it, see it, feel it, talk it, rehearse it into being, so that we can really, really capture, I think, an opportunity, hopefully, in the next decade to turn this around. And I think if we don't believe it, if we don't believe that, then fundamentally we are just going to keep building the same things until it becomes absolutely untenable. At which point we will then all just become disaster management people. And that's what we should be preparing for. I really appreciate what Gavita said about those CAT students, because that's just an example. Like, there is so much imagination and possibility, and we've got to find it. We've got to find it amongst ourselves, and the most privileged and the most resourced really, really need to as well. But I'm actually not really a professional or have learned in the built environment. In my life, I've just been enamored by possibility and completely frustrated forever. Why have we not brought this into being? And that's just what's inspired me. So I'm actually going to hand over to my built environment expert colleague, Charlie, to have the last word and put on behalf of us and see what you have to say, Charlie, to wrap us
go
up.
Go off, Charlie. Give us the mic drop moment.
Yeah, no pressure. There's already been two mic drops, like, from you two, just casually, yeah, bigging me up for the final
bit. It might be a total setup.
No, for sure.
Okay, well, we'll rate the mic drop after you've done it.
I should have bought an air horn just to, like, add some extra gravitas to when I'd say absolutely nothing. But I guess maybe taking a step back and thinking from the perspective of, I guess, yeah, like, predominantly sort of built environment people who might be likely to listen to this. I think if in listening to this, you're kind of conclusion is that the only way to work towards the just transition is to do it through a sort of philanthropically funded organization, you know, that's definitely not the only way. I think, as much as I'd love there to be an absolute wealth of opportunity to do this kind of work, there's simply not enough of this kind of funding in the world. So you have to identify, you know, what your position is and how you can best kind of leverage your position towards doing this kind of work in one capacity or another. Mm-hmm. So, you know, particularly in the built environment, I'm always shouting out the Architects Climate Action Network, who came to the same realization of we are not doing the kind of work we want to do in private practice, and we fundamentally cannot do the kind of work we want to do through private practice. So we're going to organize beyond the boundaries of design practice in order to try and make that kind of work possible through a more political process. There's mutual aid, there's community work, there's unions, there's so many ways that we can sort of work, I think, harmoniously towards these kinds of conditions that we're talking about. It doesn't have to be And it cannot be full time for everyone, because that's just not how, you know, work and survival works for most people. So I think it's about identifying what is your surplus of time and energy, and how can you best apply that to this kind of outcome. And I think that's the only thing I can really add to it. Yeah, not much of a mic drop, but hopefully maybe a useful step back.
Very useful, and a great way to end. And I think the last thing I would say is that I'm actually studying at CAT at the moment. I'm doing an MSc in.
Oh, amazing. Wow.
We love CAT. Look, I'm just going to shout it out to say, if you don't know about the Centre for Alternative Technology, you need to know about it. You need to amplify it and support it. And I promise you, particularly those resourced urban design and architecture firms who could put R&D money into places, that's the place. And then you need to be working back and forth, because they knew this story, especially the demand management and reduction and resource and material justice story. They knew it years ago. They knew it decades ago. And I really, really do hope that actually a lot more, particularly architecture practices, can start to work really with those who have been thinking about this in the most radical ways, not just the ways that make us comfortable, like offsetting and greenwashing and put a green wall, and that will, you know, these guys have been thinking about it fundamentally and integrally for a long time. So, well, hey, we love Cat. Big up Cat.
Yeah. Get yourself down to Wales.
Yeah, they're fantastic. Great call to action. And it's been even just I'm doing the sustainability and ecology MSc.
Nice.
And it's even just the first two modules that I've done, it's like blown my brain open with all the possibilities and just realizing actually how much has not come into practice yet that needs to. Yeah. So I'm sort of trying to use the podcast as a little bit of a way of translating that.
But that does, like, given that they've been around for 40 years, that really tells a story though, Ross, about the arc of change. Mm-hmm. And, like, I'm not saying that we all have to spend 40 years on this, but it definitely, like you said, we've got to accelerate the way this knowledge and information is, like, shared. Mm. And I don't know if it's necessarily just a sharing piece. It's also, we also need to uplift, like, the more uncomfortable story, because they definitely tell a more uncomfortable story about material justice, of demand a reduction rather than just, like, you know, a different way to carry on as we are.
Mm.
And our colleague Kate at Deal talks really eloquently about, like, the complexity doesn't go away if you ignore it. And so what it means to bring that out and then be liberated by it and creatively interpret it, I think Kat are just a great example of that as well. So, yeah, we fully endorse it's a very exciting snippet of news you just told us at the end of this podcast.
I know.
I'm glad to hear. I made the right choice. Okay, guys, I will let you go now. Thank you so much for the conversation. It's been amazing, and I actually can't wait to listen back to it myself. Just absorb it all.
Yeah, that's a good sign. Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much.